Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest podcast. Great to have you along. Here we are then, the March 2015 podcast, and I'm recording this just a couple of days after getting back from the Blackpool Convention. And so my voice is just slightly croaky. It might be because of all the talking that goes on while you stand behind a dealer stand for 3 days. I always think it's a funny thing when I reflect on Blackpool, because I have a very, and I suspect other dealers in the room too, have a very singular view of whether it's been a success or not. For us, it's nothing to do with how good the gala shows were, or what the standard of the close-up competition was like, or the children's magic competition, or whatever it might be. It's nothing to do with any of that, of course. It's, did we take lots of money? Was there a lot of interest generally in the dealer hall? And I got the impression, and I've had the impression now for the last few years, that the dealer hall, now that there are 3 days in which people can come and look at stuff, the dealer hall is not the busy place that it used to be. Yes, people come and look round, but they do it at all sorts of different times, and with a very busy programme that that Derek Lever and the others organise for the conventioneers, it is sometimes difficult for them. This is for the people who are coming along to the convention, for them to find the time, and indeed, to some extent, the energy to have a concerted look around the dealers, especially when there are so many of them. You know, if you've got 125, 130 dealers, that's a mass of magic. And sometimes when I have chatting to somebody and I discover that perhaps it's their first time, you can see that they are completely overwhelmed by the physical size of it all. And I think if you're trying to make buying decisions as you look around the dealers, it can actually be quite difficult, because often you're in a rush. You think, oh, I've got to get off to the lecture or the show or whatever. Or you just simply are so tired that you want to go and sit down somewhere or get something to eat. And so you tend to look around the dealers in a bit of a rush, and perhaps don't give it the time that at a smaller convention you might perhaps do. So I think from the dealer's perspective, we go through periods where the room is quiet. There are just a few people wandering around. And then there'll be, perhaps at the end of one of the major lectures, there'll be a sudden rush of people coming in. But again, because there are now three large areas for dealers to be actually sighted in, of course, the people who do come into the dealer hall are then all very spread out. So you don't get so much as you used to in the old days when it was in the Horseshoe Bar, where there was literally queues five or six people deep trying to get to the 40-odd dealer stands to see what the latest miracles were. So it is a very different animal these days. And obviously also the other thing that can affect this is the internet. Whereas in the old days people would come to a convention like Blackpool in order to see stuff demmed, to see it in the flesh, to see it demonstrated. Now they don't have to do that, because most products now can be sought online and watched, have a dem watched online. You know what it's going to look like, and you've probably made a decision about whether you're interested in it before you even get to Blackpool. So in one way, it can short-track the process. You see a trick you like, you go straight to the stand and you buy it. But on the other hand, it does take away that little sort of feeling of intense excitement that there used to be in years gone by, when you were desperate to get into the dealer hall in order to rush up to a stand and see what all the latest magic was. So if you went to Blackpool, I hope you've had a good time. It is quite exhausting. It's an amazing event. It's totally unique. And how they manage to, every year, to produce such a feast of magic, it defies belief, really. So congratulations to the Blackpool Magicians Club and everybody connected with it, because it is an amazing event. And I hope that if you went, you had a really, really great time. Now, here's something to think about. If you had to define what a magic show actually is, have you any idea how you would describe what it's made up of? I mean, in a simplistic sense, you say, well, OK, a performer comes on and does tricks. But the nature of the way that the show, if you like, is put together, and the way that those tricks are performed, I think is radically changing in certain ways. And I think television is largely to do with this. Now, you think, take, for instance, Dynamo. Now, Dynamo has had, obviously, some very successful television series, and he's now trying to take that to a live sort of arena-type show. And I've mentioned before, I think, that given the way that he performs on television, very understated, no presentation, minimal patter, and so on, you kind of wonder how that is going to translate to the O2. You know, how is he going to hold a huge arena? Well, I was discussing that with some friends of mine, and one of my friends showed me and sent to me a link on YouTube, which showed Dynamo performing and producing a car for a car launch. And, you know, he said to me, well, maybe this is the way that he's going to do it. And I don't know whether you've seen it, but it's a particular car brand which they appear to be marketing with Dynamo sort of producing in a very futuristic way on a sort of a stage with a what looks like a live audience, using lots of laser light and sort of electronic sort of imaging almost. And gradually he ends up in a car. An actual real car, the new car, obviously, in this case, is produced. But the whole way that it's done and the whole presentation, if you were to say, well, is that magic? All these laser lights and revolving stuff and almost like digital effects. It's not magic as we would see it, is it? It's electronic gadgetry, but it creates a fantastic visual effect. And the final moment when the actual car, the real car, is produced, of course, that is a magic effect. But all the build-up is very much not. So I can imagine that if he's going to be doing this type of thing, it's going to be visually very exciting and very different if this was the sort of the benchmark for the type of way that he can make something very large for his big arena shows. But whether it's magic is another thing entirely. I think it's one of these things where television has gradually, in any case, blurred the edges of what we consider to be magic. In any case, if you think about the number of tricks that are now hugely enhanced, not by camera tricks, but certainly by selective editing these days, then clearly things are on the move and have been for some time. And the days when, perhaps when Paul Daniels was at his peak, where it was almost like basically a cabaret show or a stage show that was on TV and was filmed, now it's not. You know, with out in the streets and magic being done in unusual locations around the world, extraordinary things being achieved by, well, the performer apparently doing something, but clearly he can't be. I remember the thing where, in one of Dynamo's shows, where he sort of like froze an indoor water fountain. Things like this, it's sort of a magic trick, and yet it isn't if you analyse it. So very interesting, and I think if this is the way that Dynamo is going to do his shows, it's going to be very, very exciting and very interesting, and it'll be fascinating to see how the lay public take to it. In years gone by, I used to bring out tricks, new effects, new products, twice a year. I used to bring out some for Blackpool in February, and then I'd attend the British Ring Convention in September and bring out a few more then. These days, I tend to spread the new release, the sort of dates, if you like, throughout the year. But on this occasion, I did add 5 new items to my catalogue for Blackpool. And in fact, I've only just added them on the 1st of March to my website. And 2 of them I'm particularly interested and excited by because I've made a couple of audio books. I've never tried this before, and it struck me that I really enjoy listening when I'm in the car on a long trip up the motorway to audio CDs. Most commonly I listen to business advice CDs, And I find you can absorb a huge amount of information, and it really helps the journey to go by. And although I like to listen to music as well, I'm actually more interested by the spoken word. And it struck me that with my new series of ebooks, which are under a banner of the Professional Worker series, that it would be a good idea, the two titles I have so far, which are Trade Show Magic and Going Walkabout, which are both, they don't have tricks in them, but they are advice ebooks. These would be an ideal thing to turn into audio books that people could listen to in the car. So that's what I've done. Actually, it was quite interesting recording these, because although I've written the ebooks, when you read them, it's not as easy as you think it's going to be to make it sound interesting and make it sound sensible, make so that people can understand what it is you're saying. But hopefully I've done a reasonable job. And I think it's a really good way to assimilate information. You can listen to these things more than once, of course. And I think when you're driving along, or you're jogging, or you're in the gym or something like that, then it's quite nice to feel that you're doing something to do with magic at the same time. So the Going Walkabout audiobook, that lasts about 55 minutes. And that's, of course, all information about how to do mix and mingle magic, where there are no tables, where your audience is standing. And I go into great detail about all the various aspects of how to succeed with that. And then obviously Trade Show Magic, well, it is what it says. It's actually a 68-minute audio book in which I talk about my technique for doing trade shows, a technique that's been hugely successful for me over the last few years. And I go into great detail there as well about the various aspects of things that you need to think about if you're going to do trade shows, because it's not the same as doing just an ordinary social type of booking. When you're the magician at a trade show, there's a whole different set of parameters that you need to take into consideration. So each of those audio books retails at £12. If you go to the website, you can see the details there. And I'm hoping that if you get those, that you'll find them really interesting and a great way to learn. Quite a lot of people put quite a bit of store in being a bit creative, in finding better or more interesting ways to perform tricks, or just coming up with new plots. And I was thinking the other day about how creativity itself is stimulated, how it starts, because it's one of those things that sometimes you can sort of force it. You know, if you shut off the computer and don't answer the phone and shut the door and kick the family out of the house, give yourself some free time and where you can concentrate on just playing with things and seeing if this just the fact of fiddling with a prop or with some sort of half of a routine that you've been learning, and then things start to occur to you. But other than the aspect of playing, which is a very important, I think, element of creativity, how else does creativity sort of start? Well, I think it needs a stimulus of some sort. It needs a point at which you go, I could do so and so with that. So it could be that you go to a lecture and you see somebody describing a move or a basic idea that you then immediately, it springs into your mind how you could take that and adapt it in a different way. Or you might be watching a DVD, or maybe, shudder the thought, reading a magic book. Wow, really? Then again, something there sparks off a thought in your head. But one of the key things for me is performing, actually going out and doing shows. And I think this is one of the most important stimulus that we actually get. Because when you're out performing, things happen, situations arise, you say things or you do things on the spur of the moment that you hadn't expected to do. And you think, wow, that was brilliant. Something that would never perhaps have happened normally in just practice, but which in the pressure and the excitement and the adrenaline burst of a show, you suddenly do. And you think, whoa, that was awesome. I've got to remember that. And so you find that over a period of time, a trick that starts out being performed in one way with a certain type of presentation or patter can gradually morph into something very different through performance. So actually performing it rather than just practicing it is a very good catalyst. But the other thing is, it also sets up a situation that you, or a problem, if you like, a performing problem that you might then seek to solve. So, for instance, I may be thinking, okay, I've got a very special wedding I'm going to be doing strolling magic at. It'd be really nice to have a new wedding specific trick. Now, because I have a show to go to at some point in the future, and it's given me a very specific, therefore, time goal, as well as an actual goal of the type of show that it is, then I find that starts to get my creative juices going. So, okay, what can I do? And the nearer that this event comes, the more concentrated I find I become in trying to solve the problem of what I'm going to do that's different. Now, if I didn't have the show to go to, I probably wouldn't pursue a particular line of thought at all because, well, there's no reason to. Other than the fact you might say to yourself, well, okay, I want to invent a new trick today. But if there's no real purpose or no moment at which that trick is going to become important to you, then the chances are you probably will sort of let it drift and then you won't do it. So I find that having a goal that is set because of a particular show is a really good way to spur me on to create new magic. And if you're a performer, I suspect that that's when maybe you too get quite creative. It's been noted on a number of occasions, of course, that many magicians these days prefer to learn their magic via DVD rather than learning from books. And it was noticeable at Blackpool this year. I don't think there was a single dedicated book dealer. The days of Goodliffe Publications, when they used to bring their vast array of books, and of course magic books by post. In the old days, they used to be very successful businesses. And the number of books being published was huge, because anybody who wanted to get their work out there, bearing in mind that in those days there was no electronic alternative, there was no e-book, and very little actually self-publishing that was going on. So it meant that when a book came out, and a lot of them did on a regular basis, it was quite a major event. And people like Magic Books by Post would have almost like a standing order with some of the book publishers in the United States, that as soon as the latest books come out, they just sent them copies, because they knew that people would want immediately to get hold of the latest titles. Now, of course, well, books do come out. Well, Magic Scene, for example, having just published John Carey's latest book, Crafted with Carey, and last year we published Wayne Dobson's definitive collection, a massive book. Both those books are testament to the fact that, yes, good books still do get published, but they're sold individually. You know, they're not sold by a massive book dealer. There are some magic book dealers around still. H&R Magic Books in the United States is one that jumps to mind. But generally speaking, whereas some dealers will just handle a few books, the days of the dedicated book dealer perhaps are numbered, if not already gone. It's a pity, really, isn't it? Because there's something very substantial about a book. I think particularly a good quality hardback book. Not only does it look great on your shelf and does it last longer, but actually physically reading it is very pleasant. Anybody who enjoys books as a physical object will relate to that, I'm sure. And when I look on my bookshelf and see some of the books that I'm particularly proud of or that I enjoy, I still pull them out of the shelf and flick through them from time to time because they are just pleasing physical objects. So I think it's a real pity if more and more things become digital because there is no substance to that. And whereas, of course, yeah, it's important sometimes, or at least one way to look at it is that there are certain things that it wouldn't be worth putting into. There's not enough content to make an entire book out of. But an e-book, which can have just a small number of things in it, makes it practical. It means people get their ideas out there. They get them published. Others can read them. Then that seems to work okay. But in terms of a major body of work, less and less people do that, and they prefer to do DVD instructions or bring things out one at a time. And even DVDs, if you look at those, most things now have become one-trick DVDs, perhaps with a couple of extras. You see less of the big DVDs that have, say, 12 items on them. Yes, they're still there, but at one time that was all you got, whereas now lots and lots of tricks come out with DVD instructions, and so the one-trick DVD has kind of taken over. But of course, moving on slightly from that, I've noticed that there are now one or two dealers who are starting to supply products that don't have any instructions actually packaged in there at all. There's no DVD, but there are no printed instructions. All you get somewhere on the packaging will be a URL. And obviously, you know, you link onto that and then you get access to online video instruction. I sort of wonder how that works for people who are not particularly keen to go online. And there are still some people who are not particularly IT savvy, or who simply just don't want to have to get involved in all of that as they see it. But I can see that, you know, in terms of production costs, it keeps it down. And it does mean that you can also perhaps update certain things because you only have one centralized feed that everybody's logging onto to look at. But it does make you wonder, okay, so if you're not getting any instructions for the product that you've bought and that it's online, what about if in 5 years' time you get the trick out and you think, right, now how was this done? And you log on and the URL doesn't work anymore, or the company's gone bust. You have nothing. You have the trick, but you don't have any instructions of any sort that you can now have access to. And so I do wonder slightly whether that's going to be a problem in the long term, even if it seems like a sort of a trendy and cost-efficient way to do it for the present. Now, as I'm sure you know, I'm the co-owner and editor of Magic Scene magazine, and we've reached a rather interesting landmark as we've just completed our first 10 years of publication, and we're pretty proud of the fact. Doing anything in publishing, particularly magazines, is not easy these days, but I think we've made a pretty good fist of it, and I'm proud of the 60 issues that we have produced to date, and with the vast amount of content, valuable content at times, I think, that's included in those. Because I think magazines, yes, they're kind of topical sometimes, although with ours, it being a bi-monthly, we don't have a huge amount of time-sensitive stuff. But we do have a lot of information about major events, but also major people. We love to have interviews and so on. But also in the magazine, we've always tried in every issue to have something that gives value, that gives help or advice. And I think over the 10 years, there's been a tremendous amount of good information, both that's come directly from us, but also from people who we've got information from, experts in their field who've been generous with their time and also with their information and advice and tips. In fact, if you're wondering what the highlights are of all of the 60 issues that have already been, well, if you go onto the Magic Scene website, magicscene.co.uk, and you look on the homepage, there's a free PDF that you can download, in which I've done a little synopsis, just a brief one, for all 60 of the editions that we've had up to now. And it makes really interesting reading, I think, because it reminds you of all the things that there are. It's only, it doesn't list everything, although you can get the contents. If you really want to know what the contents are of any of the Magic Scene issues, if you go to the Magic Scene website again, there are indexes there, and you can look up what every single, most of the contents, all the major parts of the contents of every issue. But this little PDF called Do You Remember This? I think it makes a really interesting reading, and it makes you realise how much good information there's been there. So now with the March issue, we've started our next volume that's starting off with, we've got Mel Mellors on the cover. And this particular issue is our anniversary, 10-year anniversary issue. So we've got the story of Magic Scene in there, and plus a load of other sort of special goodies too, and a slightly bigger than normal issue. We've changed the design of the magazine this time as well. We've even changed the paper it's printed on so that it comes up fresh. So if you haven't seen the latest issue, go to the Magic Scene website and have a look and get yourself a copy. I'm sure you'll enjoy reading it. I was doing a big show that needed several magicians a few years ago, and several magicians were all sort of like setting up their stuff in a room before we went out to work, and I'd finished what I tend to preset anyway, so I don't have anything very much to get ready, and I was just sitting there and I was watching one of the other performers taking things out of his attaché case and putting them into his pockets and so on. And it struck me that many of his props, just how tatty they looked. He'd brought out some rope, and the rope, which clearly at one time had been white, was now almost grey. I mean, it had been used for so long. And a deck of cards, the box, the flaps were sort of all loose, and the box itself looked like it was a bit bashed. And when he took out and he was running through the cards, and they looked slightly bent. And I thought, oh my God, you know, this, I'd never really thought about it before, but we look at our own props, and because we're so used to them, we just use them. We may not be too analytical about the way that they look, the condition that they're in. But actually, if you then present them to an audience who are seeing you for the first time, and you bring out a piece of rope that's supposed to be white and it's actually gone grey because it's so old, or it's just grubby, or the ends are completely frayed and look like a mess, then it's really perhaps not the sort of impression we want to give. It looks unprofessional. So I've always tried, ever since I saw that, I started to try and look at my own stuff. For instance, one of the things I always do before I go out to do a show, I have an Akito box, which I use in my walkabout coin box routine. And I use it every time I go out to work if I'm doing a mix and mingle. And I always go to the trouble of getting the Brasso out and polishing the brass box so that it looks shiny and doesn't look dull or dirty. I hate using Brasso, it stinks, and I hate actually doing the job, it's a nuisance, but I make myself do it because I want the prop to look really nice when I take it out of the prop. Same with a pack of cards. A pack of cards may still be very serviceable, but as soon as it starts to get a little bit bent, I throw it away and I use another one just to try and make sure that that it looks in its best condition. The same with, I do equal ropes for lay people. I regularly change the ropes. Probably way before they perhaps need to be changed, but I just want them to look their best, because I think people do, especially when you do close up and they're very physically close to you, they get to see your props, maybe they get to handle them too. So something that's a bit gnarled and has obviously seen better days, I don't think gives the right impression. And of course it's the same with children's props. Some of the paint chips off, or the dog-eared cards that are used in tricks can start to look a bit yellow or just through age. And I think, again, because we're using them all the time, we don't necessarily look at them the way other people look at them when they see them for the first time. So I think it's a really good idea just to try and stand back occasionally, just try and take an analytical look at the props we use and say, well, okay, does this need smartening up? Does it need repainting? Does it need recovering? Does it need throwing away and starting again? I spent the 3 days at the Blackpool Convention with my good friend Chris Payne, and we go every year together. And we were discussing the way that the standard of close-up performance by the top people in the art form, how much it's improved. I mean, he and I are both Zena Bennett close-up trophy winners. And when we were discussing what we did back in, you know, 100 years ago when we won the competition, we were discussing the sort of the tricks that we used and the things that we did. And then sort of fast forwarding to the present day and seeing some of the amazing things that the performers in, say, in the International Magic Competition in November, or any of the other FISM, any of the other big competitions, and you see the standard and the levels that the top people get to, it really makes you realise how much things have moved on and how much things have progressed. And actually, it's a really good thing, I think, because the standard is a lot higher. And it's great because it pushes constantly creative people to be ever better and to go to that extra little bit to create something that's really, really worthwhile. Right, we're out of time. Gosh, where did that half hour go? Well, listen, thanks ever so much for logging on to this and listening to it. I've had some very nice comments recently about the podcast. It appears that people enjoy it, so I'm really pleased about that. It's nice to know that a little bit of effort that is required to make it is being appreciated and people enjoy it. So I'll be back again in April. In the meantime, have a good month.